de un mejor destino para ti, lo que viniera de ti.
Welcome to the Inside the Journey podcast. This is episode number 15 for Sunday, August 11th, 2013. I'm Nelson DeWitt. John Younger is still out, but we are the team behind the documentary film Identifying Nelson, Buscando a Roberto. If you guys are wondering where John has been, he's actually getting married next weekend, and he is up to his eyeballs in wedding stuff. Hopefully he will be back with us once all of that settles down and he has returned from the honeymoon. Today we're going to be doing something a little different, and I'm going to be bringing you an interview that was recorded over 3 years ago. This interview was part of a live web series that I did as a way to try and tell my family story online. The show really didn't work out or do anything, but the byproduct of it was this amazing interview and the documentary film. You see, John had been helping me at the time, or he was just starting to get involved, and he actually lent me the recording equipment so that I could do the whole show. And it was after seeing my parents talk that he came up to me and he said, "We have to do a film about this because it is so powerful." And that's when this whole journey really started. This interview has a lot of historical significance and a lot of personal meaning for me. In it, you will hear my parents talk about how they came to adopt me and the mysterious circumstances that surrounded it, and what it was like for them to get a phone call at 9:30 at night and then to have make a decision about a child the next morning, which I still cannot believe that they actually did. And, you know, it's just, it's a truly amazing interview, and I want to get right into it, but I'm going to say one other thing, and that is, the other day I ran into a friend of mine, Danielle, who said she's been listening to the podcast, and it just reminded me of how far we've come. When I recorded this the first time, I think there were only four or five people listening. John was one of them. And it's such a powerful interview, but no one saw it. So I'm super excited that I get a second chance to kind of share it with everyone. So without a further ado, here is the interview with my parents about my adoption. Hope you enjoy it.
Well, I'm Margaret Ward. I'm Nelson's mom and Derek's mom. And I met my husband, Tom, in the 1970s, when we were both teaching at Wellesley College, and we got married in 1975, so we just had our 35th wedding anniversary this week. Mm-hmm. In fact, May is, I always say, too many celebrations. We have birthdays, anniversaries, graduations, and Nelson's Adoption Day, because in May 30th, 27 years ago, he was released to our custody when we went down to Honduras to adopt him. So why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, my name is Tom DeWitt. We have different last names because Margaret was already active as an academic. I was at Wellesley for a year. That's how we met. We subsequently fell in love and married. But then, because even though we were both 30, neither one of our careers were established. I was getting ready to leave teaching, and Margaret had not yet received tenure, which she ultimately did at Wellesley. And so we decided we didn't want children until we were both established. I went back to get an MBA, and in 1979, when I had a good job and Margaret got tenure, we thought, well, maybe it's time to start thinking about a family. And then nothing happened, not an unusual story. And after all the tests, the doctors suggested that if we were interested in adopting, we should. Naive as we were, we found a small adoption agency called, I think, World Adoptions. I don't know if it exists anymore, in Auburndale, Massachusetts, a community within Newton, a suburb of Boston. And we met these wonderful people. It was a very small organization. And we thought we would go in and they would just hand us a baby, and we were naive in those days.
That's maybe what you thought.
And Margaret, well, we both thought, Margaret thought we might get a child. We started in January of 1983 and thought maybe by the time your sabbatical came in the summer, it would be ideal to have a child so that you could bond more. We were, of course, disabused of our ideas and told it would take 18 months. Go
ahead. Yeah, I think, Nelson mentioned that maybe later on we'll talk about some of the things that are going on now.
Yeah.
But I was reminded, there was an article in the New Yorker just May 10th, May 10th, about a family that was adopting a little girl from Haiti, and then the earthquake happened in January. And in their story, they're talking about possibly 3 years of waiting and all of the bureaucracy and the paperwork and everything that has to be done both in the United States and in the country of origin whenever you're doing an international adoption. And so we really had to learn even back then in 1983 that this was could be a very long process.
We had decided we wanted to adopt abroad, partly because of our social liberalism, I guess. We're both academics, and we had friends who had adopted a lovely young boy from El Salvador, and we thought, well, Mexico or El Salvador or Central America would be wonderful. We realized that after it was explained to us that it would be a long process, a long home study with documentation, psychological evaluations, references, financial analysis, and then we would get to choose a country and the material would be translated and sent to that country, and then we would wait probably another 9 to 12 months.
Yeah, for a placement.
For a placement.
And these are all pretty much standard procedures.
Well, they've modified, but yes, yeah. They're still even more restrictive than they were then. They have to depend how old they are. A mother, in some cases, can't be over 30 or over 25,
country.
So some countries we weren't eligible for.
We were already in our late 30s.
And so, but anyway, we thought that El Salvador would be an idea. We started the process. The process took longer because I was professionally busy, so was Margaret. We couldn't get the meetings. The social worker was upset. But we stuck to it. And then one day, we thought we were another year and a half off. And then one day, was it late?
It was May 10th.
Okay.
That's why I'm thinking this article was written May 10th.
May 10th, we got a call. Yeah. We were already, I think, in bed, 10 o'clock at night.
It was around 9:30.
We lived in Wellesley, it's the town next to Newton. And they called to tell us that there was a boy about 2 years old who was available. And we had until the next morning at about 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning to make a decision. The things that were dramatic is, one, this boy was in Honduras, where our adoption agency did not work, so I had no contacts. Secondly, that it instead of getting a picture and a birth certificate and 2 weeks to make a decision,
and a photograph,
we got an overnight opportunity to chat. Needless to say, we didn't sleep much that night. And we were given a name of a social worker in Iowa, whom we called the next morning. And while we have a difference of what the recollections are, I remember talking to this man who said this was the most unusual experience he had had in his many years of going to Central America to facilitate adoptions. As you know, you must have a home study in order to bring a child back into the country. And if you're living abroad, which is the way many adoptions occurred through Americans living abroad, working abroad, that a social worker could be licensed to go down there and do that for them. And this social worker was doing the adoption of the first child, of what turned out to be many, for Mr. and Mrs. Negroponte. Mr. Negroponte was the ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Honduras.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of doing that adoption, he was asked to go to a private orphanage in Tegucigalpa, take a look at a child and to get him placed immediately out of the country. So he went, saw the child, pulled out his camera, and the nuns, I think they were...
This is the social worker who went down to...
Yes, the Iowa social worker.
From
the state of Iowa.
Yeah, someone who would do the required home study
for
that
the
has to be done by a licensed social worker for Americans who are living abroad. They could adopt in the courts of a country like Honduras.
But they couldn't bring them back into our
country. They wouldn't
be
allowed to bring a child back legally
into the
United States without a licensed social worker's home study.
So anyway, he did that sort of thing. He would go down there
and do the home studies.
He was not allowed to take a picture, which was very strange. He went back to Iowa, but this was planting season, and could not find anyone who could commit to 3 to 4 weeks at a minimum. Today it's often much, much longer, several years, to go down and adopt. He had heard of our agency because he also worked in El Salvador where our agency worked. So he called our agency in Auburndale, told them the story that I've just said, and said,
and do you have any likely
candidates? And if you can't find someone by tomorrow noon, I'm moving on to another agency.
Yeah.
So I made this call. He explained what he had done. He said, to me, he said, it's the most unusual experience he'd had in his professional career, and he wouldn't be surprised if it was the illegitimate son of the president. I know he said that, I wouldn't make it up. Be that as it may.
I know he said it, it doesn't mean that it was true.
Well, no, no, and he didn't say that it was.
He just said that it was really strange. This was a really strange, this was not a normal placement.
No. Well, he had no birth certificate.
Yeah, well, as you said, you didn't have any of the normal information.
No,
he had seen you.
Yeah, he'd seen you. Okay. You were healthy, probably around 2.
And cute.
Cute, and that all the powers would be mustered to help us make this happen.
Yeah, that the American embassy would be supporting us, that we would.
And he gave us the phone number of Mrs. Negroponte. Mm-hmm. And we could call her later, and she would be helpful.
At the embassy residence, yes.
And so we called our social worker and said we wanted to go ahead. We had said when we had first come that we were willing to take a slightly older child, didn't have to be an infant, and we weren't wedded to either male or female, boy or girl, which was helpful, which may have been the reason we still to this day do not know why we were picked out of by this agency when there were many people already waiting for a child.
Well, I've always sort of thought about that as being, once you had your home study just about done, within an agency, you would choose which of the countries of origin with whom they were then currently working, and that's changed over time. This agency worked in Brazil. They also placed children from the United States, mm-hmm. but some of the countries they were working with were Brazil, Colombia,
El Salvador.
Because of my age,
we're ineligible.
We were ineligible for some of the countries that had restrictions about the age of the parents or the difference, mm-hmm. age differential between parents and a child. But in any case, she probably mentioned us as possibilities because we were not quite finished with the home study.
And so we had
therefore had not committed to one of their specific programs. So we were not on a waiting list. We hadn't put our materials together for Colombia or for Brazil.
Or else we were thinking about El Salvador.
We were almost done, but we weren't tied down to waiting yet in a specific line.
We were in the process, and we had wanted El Salvador. We wanted Mexico, possibly, and our agency said, too cumbersome, too much bureaucracy, can't be done. You'll be disappointed.
So we decided
on El Salvador initially, and then they notified us that they were stopping the El Salvadorian adoption process because of a baby selling scandal, which of course later on proved to be correct, as we later learned much later in discovering Nelson's whole story. So we had thought about going to the Natal
in Brazil.
That's northern Brazil, northwestern Brazil, mostly black, but they had a relationship with an adoption agency there, with an orphanage.
Mm-hmm.
So when this came, this is of course out of blue, we thought we had another year and a half to wait.
But for us it was perfect.
We also knew that you had a sabbatical and I had a vacation.
I was just beginning a year's sabbatical. It was May. The semester was almost over. Our social worker knew that Tom was taking his 4 weeks of vacation
to go to Winnipeg.
We were going to drive to see his parents in Winnipeg. So they knew we had this 4-week window that we might have available. So I think they had sort of a sense, well, then, these people might just jump at the chance. Yeah.
So we then accelerated the process. Yeah. I called Mrs. Negroponte, and we did get through to her by using social worker's name. We got through the 3 or 4, five layers of telephone to actually get to the wife of the ambassador. She had heard of us through her social worker, was excited, said she would take care of everything, not to worry, just get here.
Yeah, get your papers together.
We accelerated everything, and of course the irony is we didn't really do the home study. They finessed part of it because it would have taken too long. We couldn't get the group meetings together.
That's it. That was the only thing.
But
we
the
did
rest,
through.
they rushed through, and we got in my case, and you had to get police records from any place you'd ever been for 6 months, and you needed certificates, and you needed affidavits. Some of it we had, some of it we didn't. I got my fingerprints. I was a CFO at Regis College in Weston. I went to the Weston Police, and they immediately took my fingerprints, so we had all of those things cleared, and we got ready. One of the remarkable things was we asked ourselves why. Not so much just us, but what was this? I believe we had three conversations with Mrs. Negroponte. In each case, he got a little older, but she kept saying he was healthy and she'd take care of everything.
Yeah, she told me bring clothes for
other
18-month-old
18 months,
child.
Yeah. And we brought toys and things for the orphanage.
Even though you were 2, you were small.
So well, nobody knew your age.
There
were no papers. Yeah. So we completed this, and we were ready to go until we realized we needed a security clearance. And it's one of the things that's always stuck in my mind. And for the longest, longest time after we adopted Nelson, in the back of our minds, we said, this is a very strange story. There's nothing typical. There's so much mystery surrounding this. We were ready to go. We got our tickets. We didn't have a security clearance. We let Mrs. Negroponte know. That's the way I remember it.
And not in that order, but that's okay.
But she accelerated by saying that it would. She say it. She would accelerate it through Kennedy staff or something like that.
We realized that it was going to take much longer
to get
the FBI clearance.
Yeah.
And so you called her back.
Yeah.
And she said, "Well, call Senator Kennedy's office, and they'll expedite it."
And they did. 2 days later, we had our clearance. But then we got on the plane. We knew where we were flying to. We did not know where we were staying or how long we would stay. We got, interestingly, obviously, it was a nervous flight, needless to say. We didn't know what our child looked like or what we were going to be confronting. And one of the stewardesses must have known or talked with us. I remember that. And she was related to Lisette Sandoval, and Lisette Sandoval was the attorney in Honduras for adoptions. And she was doing the adoption, a young woman, a lawyer, who herself had adopted, as we learned. And she was doing the adoption for Mr. and Mrs. Negroponte. And she said, oh yes, I think she said, my aunt will be waiting for you at the airport, which relieved us a little bit. We got through the process, we got through the controls, and sure enough, Lisette was there. Mm-hmm. She took us briefly, and everything was dry. We remember it was a long drought that Tegucigalpa was going through. It was dusty. She took us into town, and we stayed briefly early evening with another American family until she could make contact, and then we stayed. Then we were taken over to a villa 2 blocks from the embassy, a real significant villa, and lived with the Maxwells. They wouldn't mind her saying
many,
that.
No, so many, in the case of many international adoptions, as I understand it, people sometimes have to go to the country and be there for a long time. Or they go once, they see the child, and then the child is either still in an orphanage or sometimes in foster care for long periods of time while additional paperwork is done, and then they have to return to the country. Sometimes children are brought by organizations
to the U.S.
To the U.S., and the parents don't go to the... It can be very different. But often, families, at the moment that they know the child will be released to their custody, do have to go to the country of origin and stay there sometimes for about a month or 6 weeks or something like that. and stay in a hotel.
We didn't know.
We stayed with this family.
At the request of Mrs. Maxwell, Mr. Maxwell worked for USAID. We stayed with the family. We had a large room. They obviously had servants.
They had three kids.
We're wonderful. Yeah. And we've had a long relationship with them. So there we were on Friday evening, and it was too late to see Nelson because we couldn't see him until we saw the judge. But there were elements to those 3 weeks that were all as strange as the initial contact. Things that I don't think are going to be in your book either. And that is, I worked at an institution run by Catholic nuns, a women's college, Regis, lovely place. And they were all, of course, excited to hear that we were going to adopt. And the president, Sister Therese Higgins, whom I work closely with as the chief financial officer, said to me, I'm going to put you in touch with a nun from a different order, not Sisters of St. Joseph, who has taught in Honduras. She got us together. The nun came over to our house in Wellesley. And when she started talking, you realize how complicated this was. She explained to us the political situation in Honduras, which was dicey. In many respects, it was still the remaining banana republic in Central America. It was run by, it had a president as a figurehead, but it was run by a strong man, much like Noriega ran Panama, named General Alvarez. And she wrote us a letter of introduction to this man should we get into trouble, even though that might be a double-edged sword. So there were a lot of hidden dramas, not knowing what we might confront. Could this be a problem? But there we went. So it went very, very quickly. But it was anxiety producing.
Yeah, I have a sense that that kind of thing impacted you
more. Sure.
That I was doing a lot of the sort of just legwork of rushing around and getting all the things that had to be done. Plus thinking, okay, what do I need? Do I need diapers? Do I need, you know, collecting things to take
toys
down.
Toys and crayons, clothes.
We said we need a stroller. We need this. We need that. And so,
I
wasn't thinking that much.
But I had more
later,
of those contacts because through the nuns, we learned a lot about the political situation. Honduras was a name. We knew where it was, but we had never conceived of going there. So we were not up on the politics. We brushed up on the politics. We learned a great deal in those 3 weeks.
So one of the things that I think I remember hearing you say is that this was sort of a leap of faith on your part.
Oh, yeah.
But
I had always thought that when you were offered a placement, you'd have this time to think about. You'd see a picture of the child. You'd have a medical. You'd have sort of a sense of making a, I don't want to say a choice. It isn't like you'd go and you'd see a lineup and you'd say, oh, I want that one or this one. But that you'd have some time for reflection and maybe even you would bond through the photograph of thinking about. We had no idea what you looked like. We had really only somebody's word to go on that you were healthy. But it felt right. It felt like this is the moment. This is when we wanted to have a child. We thought we were going to wait so much longer. So, why not? It just felt right.
Well,
we didn't agonize over it at all.
No, we didn't have time to, and we wouldn't have.
We just said,
because we
said
it was meant to be.
Yeah.
It was clearly meant to be.
Yeah.
You don't get a phone call at 9 or 10 at night offering you a child unless this was meant to be. So we didn't agonize.
I don't know
if we're very religious, but we thought this could very well have been a message for us. We had said we would take a boy or a girl up to about age 2 or 3, and that may also have helped us because 90% of all adoptive parents want infants. So there may not have been anyone in the pool at World Adoptions ready to wrestle with the idea of a 2-year-old when you can get a baby. We don't know.
Or willing to take the risk of going to a country that the adoption service had
no
never
help
worked
there, and they couldn't help
before.
Us there.
Even with while it was sort of mysterious, it wasn't all that troubling to me that the American embassy was so involved because I felt that was somehow reassuring. You know, you're going off to a place, your agency doesn't know much of anything. But you had the sense there are people there who are knowledgeable about the the laws and the courts, and that there will be they will be there to help you. So if anything, at that point, I didn't feel suspicious.
No, I think the closer we got to the day, the higher the anxiety.
Yes, because we didn't know where we were going to be staying.
Because we didn't know where we were staying. We were literally flying into a country we did not know. No idea whether somebody would pick us up.
Didn't speak the language ourselves.
Didn't speak the language, didn't know we were staying, and didn't know our child yet. Yeah. It's not like we had bonded through a photograph. And perhaps in that sense, and we're not telling the whole story today anyway, because we're just telling the adoption part of it. For me personally, the most dramatic part wasn't the phone call. It was going to the orphanage on Monday morning, driving out there, seeing this cinder block building. The windows had no windows in them, no glass. They had curtains. It had. It was surrounded by a decrepit fence, part of it off its hinges, diapers and clothes hanging on the lines, not much grass, an area where the kids could play soccer or what have you, and then go into that building.
And Lisette had told us how much better this was, a private orphanage. Yeah. They no longer, the SOS orphanage no longer uses this building. They have a very much... facility. It didn't meet the kind of inner standards that.
But
at that time, that was
we
it.
We thought, oh my God.
And when we had been told this was so much better facility than the state orphanages, and we found it actually a little shocking. Just the chain link fence and the dusty yard, and the kids didn't appear to be taken out of the cribs and allowed to run around.
But when we saw it and we went in with her. Yeah. And there were nuns in habits, white habits.
See, I don't remember that.
I do. Well, it's because I worked with them. They were, or they looked like nurses, in other words. They had, or if they didn't have habits, they were in white and they had a cap.
Oh, well, I don't remember.
And I do remember that.
I don't remember how they were
dressed. And then Lisette gave them papers, and then she took us up there. And this walk, from the time we came into the building, an open area, and maybe a desk there with somebody sitting and doing the paper and walking up, I will always remember as one of the most stressful times, because you're getting close to your child and what's the child going to look like. And we go up a stair and we go down a long cinder, walls are all cinder block, not painted, very simple, clean. And you'd look into the left and the right, and you'd see either latrines, or you would see children in a room, or cribs. And then you go right to the end of this long hallway, and we turn left into a room, and all around the room were cribs.
Yeah, the kids were kept in cribs.
And then this, whether she's a nurse or a nun, walked to the opposite end diagonally from where we
came. Upstairs.
It was upstairs.
It was
opposite end of this large room, picked up a child, and put him in mom's arms. And you ended up giving him, we have it here, the Paddington Bear, which my president, Sister Therese Higgins, had given me to give to you. You looked at it and you couldn't take your eyes off of it. You gave Nelson to me to hold. And we thought, okay, we're going with you now. And then we were told we couldn't take you with us.
We had to now that we had seen you and had held you briefly, and the nurses, I remember, said, Mama, Dad, you know, Papa, or something like that to you. But you weren't really responsive verbally, or... You were kind of quiet and didn't do much of a smile, but you really latched onto this bear. And then we had to put you back in the crib and go away and go back to the judge and say, yes, we'll take him.
And then
that was hard.
Yeah, and then we had to have a social worker come and look that we weren't going to keep you in a hovel. Well, of course,
the social worker had to come
home
and inspect where we were going to take care of you while we were waiting for the adoption procedure to take place.
And in some ways, to make it contemporary, the story, given the tragedy with the Russian child, when we went back with Lisette to see the judge again and had more paperwork and then connect with the social worker and go to the house and do all of that and then go back to pick you up, I remember saying, seeing all of this poverty, maybe we should take another kid with us. And you said, get a grip on yourself.
I said, I don't think I'm up to this, two at one time.
But then we did pick you up. We were in the, she had a sort of a mini truck. And we were all sitting in there. We stopped on the way to pick up her daughter from a Montessori school.
And a friend.
And then we drove back to this wonderful house we lived at where the Maxwells were waiting. And of course, there were all these help there, and they could all, you know, were all embracing you. And we took you to the backyard to sit around so you could run, because you were pretty, you were a little chunky, but you were clearly healthy.
Of course, you weren't always totally perfect.
No, no, you've had your, every family.
You started throwing tantrums right away. I said, my goodness, why did we ever say we'd adopt a two-year-old who's in the terrible
I was ready to say when you threw your first temper tantrum at the
Maxwell's house.
The Maxwell's house, to say maybe we should return.
I mean, we were joking.
Of course, but yeah, it was stressful.
Yeah, it was tough.
Ooh, and you were, you had a ferocious temper. You threw yourself on the floor and you screamed for half an hour. And Mrs. Maxwell just said, oh, leave him alone. We thought they'd go through the roof. They were wonderfully tolerant. He'll get over it if you don't react.
Yeah, and you always thought, oh, if we'd been in a hotel room.
What would you do? Yeah, what would you do in a hotel?
I have some pictures here that I wanted to put up and just, you know, quickly say, you know, what you remember, if anything, from these moments.
Okay.
Some family pictures, so you can tell us what you think here. So this is from... Okay. The first day that we...
Right. Yes, we had the crib in our room.
Yeah, they had loaned us a crib. One of the children, the youngest Maxwell daughter, gave us her bedroom. And we had a bed, and you had the crib. And we had brought some stuffed animals and other toys. I have to laugh because there was a blue rabbit.
Yes, in the...
In the corner there. I think that came from the Hansons, actually. And I noticed in this article about the man who, in the New Yorker, who had adopted this little girl, and their family had adopted the first thing he gave her was a little blue rabbit. Mm-hmm. Again, when he saw her the first time, and she, you know, hung on to that rabbit. So you had a blue rabbit, and I think you're smiling in that picture.
Yeah.
Well, you were amazed. The first thing we did before we actually took you home was to take, the orphanage wanted the old clothes you were in back.
Yeah, we had taken some
And we
clothes.
Obviously had colorful things for you to wear, tops and pants,
that made
shorts.
You smile.
And it made you smile. You looked at them, you'd never seen anything like it. They were colorful.
Well, we have one here.
Yeah, but the shoes that we brought were all too small.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So you were still barefoot for a while.
Yeah, that's what we put you in.
Yeah, that was one of them, not the first day, but that was one of them. Yeah,
yeah. So you fit into that.
Yeah, and I have a picture of here I'm wearing it. And this is...
Yeah, that's in the backyard at the Maxwell's house. And I'm swinging you in one of those...
hammocks.
Hammock swings, And you're laughing. I mean, you liked good fun, and you liked being able to run around in the yard, and kick a ball and things like that.
Yeah, and you clearly were, given that you spent so much time in a crib.
You didn't know how to walk upstairs and.
No, but you could run around, and you very quickly became quite mobile. Yeah. Clearly, before we left, you were pushing the stroller instead of being in the stroller.
And we have that picture here.
Yeah, right.
There you are. Yeah, there he is.
Yeah. So when we left, a month later, we left the stroller there.
Yes.
We didn't take the stroller home. You clearly were not intending to use it.
We didn't live far from a small shopping center, so we could go there every day because it was hot, and go into air-conditioned areas, and you could go up and down the escalators and the ramps, and you had a great fun. And you were healthy. We took you on Tuesday to a Boston Children's Hospital educated Honduran doctor who was taking care of Mrs. Negroponte's child, and she had asked him to be available for us, and he looked at you and pronounced you healthy. You had some worms, you got some medicine, but other than that, you were in great shape.
Yeah, you had to be treated for parasites.
Yeah, that's very
normal.
Common.
And even at the orphanage, they gave a little report about mm-hmm. your health status. I mean, we hadn't had one in advance.
No.
But...
Well, we didn't get a sheet. Wasn't so much a sheet.
No.
It's just a verbal report from the doctor.
Yeah, but they gave me a little list of the food that you had been eating.
Yeah.
They told me that you'd been a difficult child.
Yeah, well, we knew that.
Because you always wanted to be the first to eat. But
yeah. You were difficult, and we think it was because you were a survivor.
You had these survival skills. You were actually pretty healthy.
Yeah. So we have this photo. Which
oh, yeah. That was the day that we left to fly back home via Miami. We had to go through another series of steps to bring you into the country when we got to the airport in Miami.
Here's our ticket.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. And we had two.
So June 25th.
Yeah.
Right?
June 25th.
Yeah. And this next photo is probably one of the most, I think, compelling, at least for me.
It is. It's, we love it. There it is.
Us on the
front porch.
Front porch of our place in Wellesley. You're dead tired. We're tired, but we're smiling. We're home.
Yeah.
A remarkable story.
And that concludes the interview I did with my parents about my adoption story. At the end of the interview, you heard us mention several pictures. Well, you can't see those pictures because you're listening to the podcast, but I've put high-resolution versions of all those photos on the website, so you can head over to the show notes and check them out. Of course, if you're listening to the enhanced version of the podcast, which you can get through iTunes, those pictures will pop right up and it'll give you a link to where you can view them in greater detail. So that concludes the interview, and a lot of what we talked about today was actually in my mother's book, Missing Mila, Finding Family. She goes into even more detail about the amazing journey that they went through to adopt me. And then, of course, they get into the reunification of my family and meeting them for the first time, and then the history of El Salvador. You can grab a copy of that at missingmila.com. That's our show for today. You can subscribe to the podcast by going to iTunes and searching for Inside the Journey. We should pop right up, and then you hit the subscribe button. That's the best way to get the latest episodes when they come out every Sunday. We'd love to hear from you, so head on over to Facebook/Identifying Nelson and leave us a comment. And if you could do me a favor and just go there and congratulate John on his wedding. He got married yesterday, and I know he was super excited about it. Even if you're hearing this months later, just head over and congratulate John. He'll love it. If you enjoy the show, please be sure to share it with anyone you think would enjoy it, and tune in next week. I hope to be talking with my friend Clarence Smith Jr. about the challenges of storytelling and his project called Bold Edition. That's it for now. Thank you so much for listening, and cue the music.